Today I'm going to talk about the Buddha nature. And a few days ago, someone asked whether the Mahayana idea of Buddha nature did not somehow restore the notion of Atman. And I'd like to answer that question. I hope this won't be too technical. As you may not be surprised, given what I've said so far, Buddha nature is... Buddha nature is problematic simply in the way... The very word Buddha nature is problematic because it's a bad translation. There is no word in Sanskrit or Pali that corresponds to the English word Buddha nature. Scholars have looked far and wide for a term like Buddha Svabhava and have never found it. So why then has this term, Buddha nature, become so widespread in the English-speaking world at least? Même en français, on dit la nature de Bouddha, on dit ça tout le temps. Or the Buddha nature, I'll throw it. And possibly in Hebrew we say something similar. Now, again, this is a curious accident of history. I think the first time the word Buddha nature was used in English was probably in the writings of Bhikkhu Suzuki, the Japanese Zen scholar who did so much to introduce Buddhist ideas, and particularly Zen and Mahayana Buddhist ideas, into the English-speaking world. Suzuki was working primarily from Chinese and Japanese sources, and he translated the term in Chinese, Fo Xing, as Buddha nature. And that was perfectly correct. Fo Xing. Fo means Buddha. Xing means nature. Nature in the sense of the essence or the nature of something. Not in the sense of nature like the birds and the bees and the buttercups. So nature is an idea that has to do with an essential nature. Now here already we have a problem, because surely so much of Buddhist thought has been a sustained critique and suspicion of the very idea that there is an essential nature. Nagarjuna, who's probably the best example of this trend in Buddhist thought, is sometimes called a Nisvabhavadin, someone who declares that there is no nature, no essence. That the idea of emptiness, for Nagarjuna and others, means seeing through the illusion that there is an essential nature somewhere to oneself, to another person, to a thing, to anything. In modern philosophical language, Buddhism, in this tradition at least, of Nagarjuna, and I would argue the Buddha too, is a non-essentialist tradition. In other words, it doesn't posit, it doesn't believe that there is a kind of permanent essential nature underpinning the world of appearance. And hence the Buddha's emphasis in his account of his awakening to the dependently arising, fluctuating, changing, contingent nature of reality, with nothing underpinning it, or nothing necessary to underpin it. That's his liberation, to realize that we can be freed from such, for him, constricting ideas. And so now we have this word Buddha nature that seems to suggest the opposite. That in fact, hidden somewhere within us, there is an essential nature of a Buddha. It's a beautiful idea. I'm not disputing that. But it reintroduces the specter of a self of some kind. We don't have the Atman, say the Buddhists, but luckily we have the Buddha nature. So we kind of sneak the Atman into the back door. The self, in the sense of a sort of permanent, abiding, essential identity. Now, this kind of idea is well illustrated in some of the classical Mahayana texts. I'm thinking particularly of a work called the Ratnagotra Vibhanga, in which a Sangha, in this case a Mahayana philosopher, compares the Buddha nature to the seam of gold in an ordinary piece of rock. He compares it to the honey in the honeycomb of the beehive. He compares it to the a golden Buddha image wrapped in dirty cloth. Now, as inspirational ideas, I think these are very positive. Because for someone who feels perhaps a sense of despair, a sense of loss, a sense of pointlessness, we can point to the possibility that within that despair, there lies a potential, something else, something that can come forth, that is not confused and solid, but is awake, is brilliant, is bright. But the problem with the metaphor as a kind of philosophical idea is that it again splits reality into two. These are overtly dualistic images. The gold is not the same as the rock. They are two different things. You take one out of the other. You discard the rock, you preserve the gold. You melt the honeycomb and you preserve the honey. You throw away the piece of dirty cloth and you honor the statue of the Buddha. Such is an imagery much more akin to the idea of some kind of abiding self. And one could see how in India, particularly as Buddhism became more and more Indianized, if you wish, Brahmanized, that the notion of Buddha nature must have been very comforting, very inspiring, very positive. But I would argue that it actually goes against the thrust of what the Buddha was trying to teach. Now, if there is no word Buddha nature, then what is the word they use? There are two terms that we translate now as Buddha nature. Perhaps the most important one is Tathagata Garbha. Tathagata Garbha. And the other one that you find very commonly is Buddha Gotra. When the Tibetans talk about Buddha nature, they talk about Sangyogyuvut, which is a translation of Buddha Gotra. I'll come to this in a minute. First of all, let's look at this term, Tathagata Garbha. Tathagata is a rather curious term, and I'm not going to go into it now, but it means something like the one thus come, or the one thus gone. And it's the word the Buddha uses to talk about himself. Instead of saying me or I, he says the Tathagata. The Tathagata does this and the Tathagata does that. So in other words, Tathagata just means Buddha. Garbha doesn't, though, mean nature. It means womb. It's the womb of the Tathagata. The womb. Now this is a very different order of metaphor from nature. the nature of something, the essence of something. It's very different to saying the womb of something. The womb is an extraordinarily fleshly, female, productive image. Womb, what is that in Hebrew? Recha, there you go. So this is the Buddha womb. Now a womb, if we think of it a little as a metaphor, what is a womb? A womb is an empty space. But it's not just an empty space. It's an empty space that can be fertilized. It's an empty space that can be impregnated. It's an empty space that can then nurture an embryo, a child. It can nurture life. And it can nurture it to the point where that life can be given birth and can enter into the world. It's a biological metaphor. It's a metaphor of the flesh. It's a metaphor of reproduction. And it's quite curious that celibate monks living in monasteries would have come up with this idea. It's somehow against the assumption we might have. But curiously, when it was translated into Chinese, when it was translated into Tibetan, the Chinese and the Tibetans, although they have a perfectly good word for womb, didn't use it. The Chinese said forcing, Buddha nature. The Tibetans said gazing at the nimble. Nimble means like the heart essence. Nim is heart. Nimble means heart in the sense of the heart of something. The heart of the Tathagata. They could have said this and said they know the womb of the Tathagata, but for some reason they didn't. Maybe the translators were a bit squeamish. They found it a rather an awkward idea. And as a consequence, since the first translations were done from Chinese, if they'd been done from Tibetan, we would have had the same thing happen. We end up with Buddha nature. And we lose. We lose something very vital. We lose the metaphor of the womb. So in other words, this is an idea that suggests that the human organism is in some sense like a womb. It's, or let's say the human mind, if you prefer. Something that can be impregnated by an idea, by a value, by a practice that can then be nurtured in the same way that an embryo is nurtured until it gives birth to a Buddha. I mean, obviously, no, we don't literally sort of give birth to a Buddha, but our being becomes more Buddha-like. And this is the consequence of a process, of a natural process, a process of growth, a process of dependence arising through practice, through nurturing certain values, through holding to certain truths, to living our lives in a conscious and moral way. We give birth, we gestate a Buddha. And that Buddha, of course, is no different from us. It too is a living, breathing, conscious awareness of life. Now the other word that is used is Buddha Gotra, as I mentioned. Now what does Gotra mean? Gotra means family or lineage. Again, it's of much the same order as the metaphor of womb. Wombs are where families begin, where lineages start. It too is a metaphor of the living organism, of life, of reproduction, of continuity. It's not an image of some essential nature. So, when I studied this in the Tibetan tradition, with Buddha Gotra, Sangha Jivit, rich or family was seen not so much as some potential for becoming a Buddha, but actually it gave, it's a framework for a Buddhist spiritual typology. That people are born into different families of awakening. And traditionally there are three. There is the family of the disciples, those who listen, the Shravaka, the Savaka, the listener, the person whose spiritual path is one of devotion, of following a teacher or a teaching and maturing according to that doctrine. Then there's the Pateka Buddha Gotha, the lineage of the solitary Buddha, the one who does not belong to a community, does not follow the teachings of a Buddha, is not even necessarily a Buddhist, but someone who comes through their own understanding, and again it's interesting, the understanding of dependent origination, they stumble across this truth by themselves. And as such, they then pursue a spiritual path independently, autonomously, and become arhats, become saints. This is an idea which again is not much talked about in Buddhism, but a notion that suggests that what the Buddha is talking about is actually something not exclusive to Buddhism at all. It says when there are no Buddhas around, no Buddhism, there are nonetheless Pateka Buddha, beings who arrive at the same enlightenment, the same understanding, but quite independently of anything we would call Buddhism. So it's a very universal sort of idea. I have a pet theory that John Keats was a Pateka Buddha. So we won't go into that. But I think many figures from many different cultures can be somehow seen as articulating and giving voice to the same basic ideas that the Buddha himself taught. And the third kind of Gotha is the Gotha of the Bodhisattva. The person whose family or whose spiritual type is one that is primarily concerned with being effective in relieving the suffering of the world, an altruistic, selfless vocation to become awakened for the sake of others. But, so in other words, that again breaks down the idea of what we typically understand as Buddha nature. Buddha nature, the more we begin to unpack this idea, the less adequate or even meaningful does the term become. And it's also with the idea of Gotra that we actually discover that Buddha nature, quote unquote, is an idea we already find in the Pali Canon. In fact, this was pointed out to me by my Tibetan teacher, when we studied this when I was a monk, and for, in this Tibetan tradition, they recognize that the beginning of the idea of Buddha Gotra starts in the early so-called Hinayana teaching. And I recently, after many years of knowing the idea, came across it in the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the four. One of the five main sections of the Pali Canon, the texts that are organized according to number, and it comes under the section of the fours, and it's called in Pali an Aryagotha, the Aryagotha, the lineage, literally the family of the Aryan. Remember that it's the Arya Satya, the noble truth. The Buddha takes this word Arya and turns it into a spiritual rather than an ethnic concept. Every human being is capable of becoming Arya, ennobled, dignified, elevated in some sense. So what is the Arya Gotha? What is the Aryan lineage? Well, for the Buddha, it comes down, as the text suggests, to four things. The first one is contentment with clothing. The second one is contentment with food. The third one is contentment with lodging, so food, shelter, clothing. And the fourth one is delight in bhavana, usually translated as meditation. But as we've seen, bhavana means literally to bring something into being, particularly the Eightfold Path. Now, again, this sort of idea pretty much explodes any common assumption about what Buddha nature is. What's contentment with food, clothing, and lodging got to do with this? What I think it says is something really rather important. Namely, that once we have achieved our material requirements, once we've achieved a kind of material security, we have enough to wear, we have enough to eat, we have a place to live, then we've somehow overcome the first hurdle of survival. Our survival is now assured. And that then leads us to the possibility of addressing other, we might call, more existential questions. What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be born and to die? We need that security in order to have the freedom to be able to pursue such a quest. So the Buddha nature is, as it were, achieved by establishing secure material conditions. And one might argue that we have here, at least in embryo, an injunction for the sort of society a Buddhist should create, one in which these basic material requirements are guaranteed, so that a fuller, richer life can begin to develop. And how is that life developed? Through bhavana, through a commitment to some sort of practice, the bringing into being of, in Buddhist terms, the Eightfold Path, the creating of a path. So it's the creating of a path that is the Buddha nature. Now, in all of these images we've had so far, we've found that the term comes back to some sort of process rather than some kind of essential thing. The commitment to a path, a womb, being part of a family. But let's now look at Buddha nature as it's understood in some of the Mahayana traditions. And again, we could spend a lot of time on this because there's quite a range of views about what Buddha nature is. And in some of them, like in the Yogacara school, you do have the idea that somehow the Buddha nature is some kind of pure mind or something that lies beneath the transient, confused, messy experience we have, some deeper kind of unconditioned awareness or something. But I'd like to look at two interpretations of Buddha nature. The first one from Dogen, the founder of the Japanese Soto school, and the second one from Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. Dogen is a particularly intriguing writer and thinker. He lived in 13th century Japan. Clearly rather a brilliant man. And his most famous writing is called the Shobogenzo, which consists of about 100 short, rather pithy essays. And if you've ever tried to read any of them, you might have found that they're not entirely easy to understand. They have a kind of enigmatic quality that's both appealing and kind of irritating at the same time. At least that's my take on Dogen. But he has one section in the Shobogenzo which is called Busho in Japanese, which is the Japanese version of Fōshin, which we translate as Buddha nature. And Dogen asked himself in this section, he says, what is Busho What is foreseeing? What is Buddha nature? And then he answers, Buddha nature is, what is this thing and how did it get here? Now again, when I first heard that, I thought, oh God, here we go again. Enigmatic and irritating. But on reflection, no. I think it's very, very profound. And it refers, in fact, to exactly what Martin introduced this morning. What is this? Dogen is here, he's quoting a passage from an encounter between two 8th century Chinese monks. One of them is well known, Huimeng, the sixth patriarch of Chan, the one who said, I quoted him yesterday, or the day before, when an ordinary being becomes a Buddha, an ordinary being becomes awakened, we call him a Buddha. When a Buddha becomes deluded, we call him an ordinary being. That's Huimeng. And the other monk involved in this exchange is a monk called Huaizhang. Huaizhang was a young guy, and he was living up in the north of China on a place called Mount Song, which is actually where Bodhidharma lived in a cave above the Yangtze. And Huaizhang hears about this great teacher down in the south called Huimeng. So he walks all the way down to near the city of Guangzhou, Canton, until he gets to the Nanhua Si, which is the monastery of Huimeng, and he's introduced to the Zen master. And Huimeng says, oh, welcome, where have you come from? And Huaizhang says, I've come from Mount Song. And then Huimeng says, but what is this thing? How did it get here? To which, not surprisingly, Huaizhang was speechless. And then, the text continues, he spent 8 years in the monastery. So what is this thing and how did it get here? Is a koan, effectively, or more technical, it's a hua dao, but never mind about that. But what it points to is the fundamental question of our life. It's a bit like, for example, you're at a dinner party. I suppose you go to dinner parties sometimes. And you find yourself sitting next to somebody you don't know. And the person says, hi, I'm John, and you are Stephen. Oh, very nice to meet you, Stephen. But Stephen, who are you really? Now, fortunately, this doesn't happen very often. But if it were to happen in such a context, you would probably find yourself a bit like Tai Dung, speechless. You would feel that this is terribly inappropriate. But more importantly, really rather very exposing. You somehow would feel kind of naked, vulnerable, thrown into a question for which there is no ready-made answer. Who are you? I'm Stephen. We all can do that. Who are you really? That takes us somewhere we would perhaps rather not go at a dinner party. But we also know that it's something that touches us deeply, that touches us in a place where we perhaps feel most confused, most vulnerable, most open, most insecure. And that's where this questioning takes place. In the practice of Zen, at least in the tradition in which I was trained in Korea, this is all we did. For 3 months in the summer, 3 months in the winter, 10 to 12 hours a day, you just sit in a darkened room and you ask yourself, what is this? That's it. There's no passing of koans in Korea where you can somehow then move on to the next one. But you just stay with this question. What is this? And you stay with it in such a way that, as my teacher used to say, it begins to coagulate like milk. It begins to somehow solidify in a strange way within you. It is no longer a question that you're asking with your intellect. That's what we do first, of course. We go, what is this? What is this? What is this? And then we try to come up, hopefully, with a suitably enigmatic Zen-like answer. But the Zen masters usually see right through that and send you back to the cushion. To a point where you just pursue this and pursue it until the mind gives up, it burns itself out with all its clever answers, all of its philosophy. And it leaves you in this naked, visceral space in which you become a question for yourself. Your life becomes profoundly questionable. And that is the Buddha nature for Dogen. In other words, this process of waking up, this process of entering this path, begins with your starting to understand that, in a way, what you most essentially are is a puzzle, is a conundrum, is a question. It provokes a sense of perplexity, or what in Zen they call great doubt. It awakens a kind of deep curiosity, which is more interesting in the end than any answer that you can conceivably come up with. You realize that that you're most spiritually alive when your life is most questionable for you. This is the opening to what some of us, what I would call, the mystery of our lives. And a mystery is not something that you solve like a problem. A mystery is something that the more you penetrate it, the more you delve into it, it only becomes more mysterious. Mystery is infinite in that sense. There's no end to it. It's sometimes thought that when you get enlightened, everything is then clear-cut and you kind of sorted it all out. And in fact, that would be extremely uninteresting if you knew everything and you had all the understandings of everything. I don't think that's the case. I think as the mind becomes clearer, stiller, more present, more aware, the world doesn't become less mysterious, it actually becomes more mysterious, more of a riddle, more of a wonder, more of something which we call sublime. It goes beyond your capacity to represent it in words or ideas. It's the deep sense you would feel in say, poetry or art sometimes, or in some great religious writings of all traditions, that they provoke this sense of mind-stopping fact, or something like that. But the point is that here we have another way of reading the idea of Buddha nature. And perhaps you can maybe see where I'm going. The word Buddha nature doesn't seem to quite work anymore. We're not talking about something in any sense at all. We're talking about a process of investigation, of inquiry, of questioning, which is not even intellectual, it's actually something that is more, there's a whole body-mind distinction that's broken down at this point. In the commentary to the Gateless Gate, which is one of the famous Zen collections, the author writes, "You must question with the marrow of your bones and the pores of your skin." It's something physical, it's something visceral. It's something that, in a way, begins almost to overwhelm you. And the idea of getting the answer and then going to the Zen master and saying something terribly profound actually becomes less and less interesting. Because what really is driving your inquiry now is this penetration into the very, or what the Chinese call, the great matter of birth and death. The great matter of birth and death. It's not hugely different, I don't think. The difference, I think that the methodology is very similar. The difference would be that it doesn't presuppose that there is an I. In fact, it tries to find a form of words that carry the least assumption possible. What is this? Who am I? Somehow supposes that as you pursue this, you will arrive at some understanding of yourself, or the self, I think, rather than a speech self, with a capital S in English, of course. But here, all of that is gone. We're just, as it were, I suppose it's a more Buddhistic kind of take on the same process, but I think as a practice, it's much the same. It's much the same. But we have to, the difference would lie really in the context of ideas that informs it. And that, I think, could be a bit different. You would not find, you know, the kind of language you would find in Ramana, in, say, the Zen text. Well, not so much. So this questioning, this inquiry, is also understood in Zen as the practice of vipassana. It's coming back to a gentleman's question yesterday. I will have questions later. My teacher used to say that when you ask what is this, you are practicing samatha and vipassana in union. In other words, if you take the question as the focus of your meditation, it is what will lead you to the stilling of your mind. But because you are focusing on a question, rather than, say, your breath, then it is also simultaneously an inquiry. So it brings together samatha and vipassana to a single point. Remember I mentioned yesterday that Dogen's practice, Sitan Taza, means the same thing. It means sitting, unification, samatha, vipassana. And I think it's very important when we think of that we practice vipassana, and thereby we watch our breath and we read the Pali text, and that's vipassana, and everything else is something different, that this is actually misleading. That all the Buddhist traditions have in common the unification of samatha and vipassana. That's, in a way, in a nutshell, the definition of Buddhist meditation. These two things in union. So that's Dogen, or a Zen reading of Buddha nature. Now what does Tsongkhapa have to say? Now this is a very different tradition. Tsongkhapa was a 14th century Tibetan Lama, the founder of the Gelug school. Again, like Dogen, a brilliant scholar, but also a yogi, and the person who somehow unified the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions that were prevalent at his time. And he created a new synthesis, which goes under the name nowadays of the Gelug school. Now, I don't know whether this idea exactly goes back to Tsongkhapa himself, but certainly it's the orthodoxy within Gelugpa monasteries today. And that is that Buddha nature, or Dzogchen Jeje Nyingbo, or Sangyogyudik, the Buddha Gotra, or the Tathagata Garba, is understood as the emptiness of the person. The emptiness of the person. So for Tsongkhapa and his followers, Buddha nature is the absence of a fixed and permanent self. It's understood as a lack, as the non-existence or the unfindability of any kind of soul or permanent identity or ego within the body-mind complex. So Buddha nature is seen as an absence of something, not as the presence of something. Now, let's just go into this a bit. Tsongkhapa is far more cerebral, intellectual than, say, Dogen. And this, and his interpretation of Buddha nature is given in the language of Madhyamika philosophy. It's not always easy to understand. But I think what the point is that once you realize that as you delve into your experience of your embodied existence, your physical experience, your emotional experience, your mental experience, nowhere within that can you ever find some thing, some fixed point, which you can say, oh, well, that's me. That's what I really am. Instead, you find just an ongoing but entirely coherent process of physical, emotional, mental events. These things are not just random, it's not just chaos that you discover, but you open yourself up to the recognition that what you are is an organic, growing, coherent continuity of, again, very much within the idea of this arising, that passing, but all according to causal and other laws. But that does not require, for its coherence, the existence of a kind of metaphysical or substantial ego or self or Atman or I that is somehow apart or different from the fluid conditions themselves. So when Tsongkhapa says that the Buddha nature is the emptiness of self, he's not saying it's the destruction of self. He's saying it's the falling away of that deep feeling we have that this is the way I am. This is what I really am. This is me. As long as you are fixated around such a feeling of ego, you're somehow stuck. There's no possibility for growth. There's no possibility to change. There's no possibility for transcendence. There's no possibility to go beyond that into an unknown. In other words, the notion of self, going back to what we were saying yesterday about Mara, is a limit condition. It's a confinement, it's a constriction. It might give you a sense of security, but it also has the cost or the price of somehow jamming the system, blocking the fluid processes of life itself. You are somehow now stuck. In modern language, we might say this is the condition of alienation. We're cut off. We're somehow apart from life. We're somehow withdrawn to the security of this nugget of me. By seeing through that, by beginning to let go, as Nagarjuna says, of this view, this opinion, this feeling, we open ourselves up to other possibilities. And from a Buddhist point of view, we open ourselves up to the possibility of awakening, of insight, of love, of wisdom. These things are now, as it were, potentially open to us, rather than something we might dream of or long for, but somehow refuse to really engage with. So Buddha nature, therefore, is really, from Tsongkhapa's perspective, a way of talking about what the human organism is capable of, were it to relinquish certain very dear attachments to an ego. If the ego falls away, the possibility of being a Buddha opens up. And so once again, whether it be the Aryabhatta and the Pali text, whether it be what is this thing of Dogen, whether it be the emptiness of Tsongkhapa, whether it be thought of as a womb or as a family, in every case we're talking about a process of transformation, of possibility, of change, of emergence, and of growth. And finally, I'd like to go back to the Pali text and look at another verse which I think is saying much the same thing. This is in the Dhammapada. I'm sure you're familiar with the Dhammapada. It's perhaps the best known collection of verses attributed to the Buddha. And I think this is verse number 80, but it might be 88. I forget and I don't have a copy to hand. I've read this verse probably many times and it had never struck me in any way at all until I came across it as an exercise in my Pali for Beginners book, my Pali Reader, which is a very good, rather challenging reader because it never gave you the English translations of the term, of the things you were meant to translate. And it didn't tell you where they were in the canon, so you could look them up. You had to figure them out. Now, so I started figuring out this verse. And this is a rough translation of it. Just as a farmer irrigates or digs channels in his field to irrigate them, just as a fletcher is a person who makes arrows, fire, flesh. Just as an arrowsmith, let's say, just as an arrowsmith constructs an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, Aptanam Dhammati Pandita. The sage, the wise person, tames the self. Aptanam, the fugitive singular. All translations translate this last line reflexively. The wise person trains himself. They somehow want to avoid having to use the S word in a positive way. But unfortunately, the Pali tells us very clearly that we're here dealing with the object of a verb in the accusative case, that the atta here, which is atman, atta is the Pali, has the same relationship to the pandita, the wise person, as the field does to the farmer, as the arrow does to the fletcher, as the piece of wood does to the carpenter. The self, therefore, is compared in each of these images again to something that is transformed and changed. The self, in this sense, is like a field, something that can be, nourished with water by digging channels, in which something can then grow. The self is also like an arrow. An arrow is an interesting idea. An arrow, compared to, say, a piece of wood, an arrow is a construction. You've got a piece of wood, you've got feathers in the end, you've got a metal point at the other end, and it's something that the arrowsmith has to put together, has to somehow construct. The self is therefore seen as something that we can somehow also construct. We can build, we can put it together. We don't have to be the way we think we are now. We can reorganize ourselves. The self therefore becomes a kind of task rather than a thing. A task in task. A task. Something to do. And thirdly, the self is compared to a piece of wood, an unformed piece of wood that the carpenter will take and with his tools and with his machines, or her machines and her tools, if it's a woman, will shape and fashion this piece of wood until it becomes, say, a bowl or a statue or whatever the person might need. In other words, again, in all three images, we have metaphors of transformation. And the self, in other words, who and what we are, is likewise something that can be transformed. And it can be transformed, it can be changed, it can grow, it can be somehow built upon and constructed, it can be fashioned, it can be shaped. And that becomes, as it were, our practice. The practice we do is actually the transformation of the self from something unformed, unfertile, untogether, using that in the more idiomatic sense, into something that is fertile, together, and formed, somehow shaped. That our body, our minds, our emotions are not just the way they are, but they are potentially capable of such shaping, transformation, molding, irrigating, and so on. And that is very much the practice. And I think that image too is an image of, I almost can't use the word anymore, of the Buddha nature. It suggests an understanding that by the idea of no self, or the idea of emptiness, is not one in which self is simply denied, and all we are is a bundle of perceptions and feelings and so forth and so on. But actually, by dispelling this fictitious sense of a fixed ego, we allow the possibility to become, in a sense, what we truly can be. The process of the path, therefore, is about what Jung called individuation. So the process of the path is not about becoming a kind of ego-less automaton, which is sometimes the impression you get. The enlightened person is just a kind of selfless machine without an ego. But actually, it's a process of ongoing differentiation. Becoming oneself. Shaping oneself. Transforming oneself. That doesn't mean that there's a self at the core, which is what you essentially are. In fact, if there were such a thing, you wouldn't be able to change. That's one of the two sort of arguments in Madhyamaka philosophy. The problem with a fixed notion of a permanent eternal soul is that transformation would then be impossible. There would be nothing transformable. It's already fixed as what it is. But I'll stop here today, and tomorrow we'll continue. Tomorrow I want to look at, in many ways, bring many of the threads that have been introduced this week into some sort of alignment, or bring them together a bit, but particularly to look at how this practice is not just one that serves our own spiritual aspirations, but one that is always embedded in a social world of others. Thank you.
One practical question, point. Can we keep this room, particularly now that it's sunny, just for sitting meditation? So if you want to do yoga, if you want to do walking, if you could please do those activities elsewhere in the building or outside. Thank you.